This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 1st, May Day, 2009. Coming up, Supreme Court Justice David Souter is expected to leave his post this summer, paving the way for President Obama to make his first pick for the High Court. As the spread of the potentially deadly flu virus continues around the world, some conservative talk show hosts scapegoat Mexican immigrants. And on May Day, we'll hear about struggles for dignity from workers around the world. I'm Catherine Kump. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Across Germany today, 500,000 people are in the streets to take part in May Day demonstrations as the country faces its worst recession since World War II. Cinnamon Nepard has more from Berlin.
In front of the Brandenburg Gate, thousands of workers have joined German trade unions calling for workers' rights and a minimum wage of €7.50. Dora Zinker, vice president of the Confederation of German Trade Unions, or DGB, in Berlin-Brandenburg, is among the crowd. She says in a climate of rising protectionism, where countries are cancelling the visas of migrant workers and closing borders to refugees, it's more important than ever to remember that this crisis affects everyone.
There will be no call for jobs for German workers or something like that. This is not the solution. Our solution must be international. The crisis is international, and workers' movement traditionally has always been international, so we have to revive that.
Later on, students, refugees and refugee action groups, the far left, anarchists and anti-fascist groups, gather under the Euro May Day Alliance, whose demonstration is accompanied by techno and colourful rescue umbrellas to cushion the fall of the thousands of people in precarious employment situations. Mark Schreiber from the May Day Alliance in Berlin.
In Germany we got this really big issue in the last years where they always told us there's no money, we can give it to the people, we don't have no money. And now in the crisis they got 500 billions out of nowhere and now the money's there to save some banks and there's still no money to save the people and we don't think this is right.
Schreiber says it's important for people to see past their own struggles and join collectively for change.
In our view, this crisis is not a single event. It is part of the system capitalism and we shall overcome it.
Accompanied by a strong police presence, this May Day parade continues peacefully through Berlin's city streets. Cinnamon Nippard, Free Speech Radio News.
Although our reporter did not witness any violence at the Berlin protests, other international news agencies are reporting arrests, burning cars, and confrontations between police and demonstrators. In Turkey, fears of violent police suppression of protesters are beginning to come to pass. In one section of Istanbul, AFP reports riot police staged three separate charges against a rock-throwing crowd. Several injuries are being reported. Large demonstrations are happening in other European cities and countries as well, from London to Greece to Russia. Tens of thousands of sex workers in India are taking the day off in observance of International Workers' Day. This according to an interview with a local sex worker by the Burnama News Agency. And to kick off the holiday, hundreds of sex workers in the state of West Bengal paraded through the streets with torches in the early morning hours, calling for the legalization of their work. Bismillah Gilani reports.
About 500 sex workers marched through the streets of Sonaghachi in Kolkata as part of a May Day rally organized by a local NGO. Sonaghachi is home to more than 15,000 sex workers and is one of India's largest red light areas. Demanding social rights and regular workers' status for millions of Indian sex workers, the marchers asserted that they are laborers and sex work is a profession just like any other. They also demanded the overturn of the Immoral Trafficking Prevention Act, a law they say criminalizes most aspects of sex work by equating voluntary adult sex work with trafficking. Despite being illegal, prostitution is a thriving underground industry in India, with more than 2 million sex workers earning their livelihood from the trade. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of Cyclone Nargis, the storm with 150-mile-an-hour winds that devastated parts of Myanmar or Burma. 140,000 people died in the natural disaster, and the international community criticized the country's military dictatorship for slow and inadequate relief efforts. A year out, cyclone survivors are still receiving international food aid, and 500,000 people are still living in substandard shelter. The Assistance Association of Political Prisoners, Burma, said today the government jailed and still holds 21 Myanmar citizens for their assistance work in the aftermath of the storm. The organization refers to those jailed as political prisoners whose only crimes were to help people and speak the truth about the humanitarian situation on the ground. Alleged Nazi concentration camp guard John Demjanjuk has lost his stay of deportation. A U.S. appeals court ruled today the 89-year-old Ohio resident can be deported to Germany to stand trial. Demjanjuk's family has argued that he is too ill to travel and would likely die before ever appearing in a German courtroom. Demjanjuk still has other appeals options available. And finally, more progressives than usual are in Madison, Wisconsin today. The Progressive magazine turns 100 years old this week, and the publication is celebrating with an anniversary conference. FSRN's Nathan Moore is on hand and files this report.
Founded by Fighting Bob La Follette in 1909, the Progressive magazine has long been a voice for the progressive movement in the U.S. The guest list for the celebration conference includes Howard Zinn, Jesse Jackson, Robert Redford, Martina Spada, Dolores Huerta, Russ Feingold, Amy Goodman, and many others. Liz DiNovella is the culture editor of the Progressive magazine.
One of the first issues we covered was the need for national health care. You know, we had a story about that in 1913, and here it is 2009, and we still have that to deal with. But at the same time, it's clearly we have made gains. Ending child labor, the right for women to vote.
DiNovella says that in a time when newspapers are going under, the Progressive's subscriber-supported Century in Print proves that there are existing models that can work and survive. Nathan Moore, FSRN, Madison.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Supreme Court Justice David Souter is expected to retire sometime this summer during the court's recess. That will give President Obama his first chance to fill a seat on the high court. FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports from Capitol Hill.
Souter was a big surprise. When President George H.W. Bush nominated him to the Supreme Court, everyone thought he was a home run for conservatives, in the words of former Governor John Sununu, who pushed for his nomination. Liberal groups protested his nomination. The National Organization of Women demonstrated outside his confirmation hearing, worried that he would try to overturn abortion rights decisions. But Souter ended up disappointing his conservative backers. Nan Aaron is president of the Alliance for Justice, a progressive group that monitors the courts.
David Souter is viewed as a justice who's moderate, who on criminal justice issues tended to vote with the Republican appointees on the court. On privacy issues, he tended to vote with Justice Stevens and Breyer and Ginsburg.
Souter supported abortion rights in Planned Parenthood versus Casey within 2 years of being seated on the court. And in 2000, he ruled with the minority in Bush v. Gore, opining that the recount should go on.
You know, because he wasn't absolutely reliably ultra-conservative, he became a target for some Republicans and ultra-conservative groups.
In 1992, the New York Times described Souter as being in the camp of jurists who view the Constitution as a flexible set of principles that can evolve. In a Fox News broadcast of a recent speech he made at George Washington University, Souter explains how change happens in judicial philosophy.
Change comes about because judges evaluate significant facts differently from the way their predecessors viewed similar facts.
But he explained it's not just hard facts that change.
It may be differing individual experiences, but more likely it is differences in the experience of the broader society over time.
Souter hasn't yet announced his plans publicly, but at least four people close to him have confirmed to the press that he is planning to leave the court when the session ends in June. Souter's retirement isn't a total shock. He's a nature buff from New Hampshire, and he's never been shy about his dislike of Washington. He's been quoted as saying he's had the world's best job in the world's worst city. He always rushed back to New Hampshire as soon as the session ended and spent his summers climbing mountains. So as Souter goes back to New Hampshire, who will fill his seat on the court? Constitutional law professor and Maryland State Senator Jamie Raskin says it's time for some soul searching.
But, you know, I think at this point it may be premature to be picking names as opposed to talking about what the general model should be. And I think the model should be someone who will be as vigorous and as forceful a figure in terms of progressive constitutional philosophy as Justice Scalia has been for a pinched and right-wing view of the Constitution.
Speculation about Souter's replacement has centered on women, since Ruth Bader Ginsburg is now the only woman on the court.
That just doesn't make sense to have one-ninth of the Supreme Court being women. So I think that there definitely is a kind of imperative there.
But Raskin says the search for diversity doesn't end there.
We have no Hispanic justices. We have no Asian American justices.
There were several names being bandied about as candidates for the job well before the news of Souter's departure. After all, John Paul Stevens is 89, and Justice Ginsburg has been battling pancreatic cancer. So a vacancy on the court during Obama's presidency has always been likely. Nan Aaron.
And I do think we will see a impassioned, aggressive effort by ultra-conservatives to keep off the court whoever President Obama nominates. We'll see a pretty significant fight coming up.
President Obama has so far refused to comment on Souter's departure or his replacement. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Hong Kong confirmed its first case of the so-called swine flu Friday, which marks the first known carrier in Asia. A man who arrived Thursday in Hong Kong from Mexico is now quarantined and being treated for the virus. 300 guests and staff at the hotel he checked into are also under quarantine. Britain, meanwhile, has verified the first human-to-human spread of the virus, also known as AH1N1. Domestically, the CDC has confirmed 141 cases in 19 states today. Just yesterday, the figures were 109 people infected in 11 states. The swine flu outbreak is President Obama's first major public health challenge. As states prepare to manage the outbreak, the federal government's approach to emergency preparedness marks a shift from the previous administration. Sam Greenspan has more from Washington.
The Center for Disease Control has expressed the importance of so-called common sense measures, such as hand washing, staying home from work or school if feeling signs of illness, and avoiding locations where swine flu is widespread. The CDC says these simple things will help prevent exposure to the N1H1 type A influenza strain, also known as the swine flu. Beyond that, however, it will fall to federal and state governments to ensure the safety of its citizens. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano announced on Monday that the Strategic National Stockpile will be opened up for national use and expects full deployment by May 3rd. The stockpile, opened by President Clinton, is meant to serve as a repository of medical supplies for public health emergencies.
And I've reached out to the governors of each of the states where a confirmed case has arisen. Everybody has a role to play here. It's our function to make sure that what the government is doing is coordinated, that we are thinking in advance of the problem. But again, government cannot do this alone. We all have an important part to play.
However, this division of roles has led to tremendous disparities of preparation between the states. Maryland and the District of Columbia, for example, only have about 70% of their individual stockpiles, while Maine has no stockpile at all. Virginia, on the other hand, has an excess of antiviral drugs. This disparity occurred because the Strategic National Stockpile is only about 60% full. Out of 80 million necessary courses of treatment, they purchased only 50 million, leaving the remainder to be purchased by individual states. States are also responsible for developing their own plans for managing an outbreak. Dr. Ed Thompson, State Health Officer of Mississippi, says that although their state has not experienced swine flu, they created their own plan to maintain public health in the event of an outbreak.
Mississippi is extremely well prepared. We've been planning for, preparing for, practicing, and even drilling our response to a pandemic of some kind of flu for several years now. 2 weeks ago, we had a live drill on the receipt of antiviral medications from the National Pharmaceutical Stockpile into Mississippi in case of a pandemic. This week, we just finished actually receiving those same antivirals. We did what we drilled 2 weeks before. The preparedness measures that we have developed have been developed by Mississippi, by other states. Some of them are recommendations by the federal government, but the basic core response to anything like this, and certainly to pandemic influenza if it escalates to that point, is something that takes place at the state level.
Putting the shared responsibility on the states was a philosophical decision that raised the risk of disparities, and we are seeing some disparities as a result of it.
That's Dr. Andrew Pavia with the University of Utah and Infectious Disease Societies of America. He has advocated since 2004 for a robust national stockpile purchased entirely with federal dollars. He says that while the effectiveness of national and state-level preparedness to address the disease remains to be seen, the Obama administration has indicated an interest in prevention based more on science than the previous administration.
The cultural change we'll see is that our scientific literacy will increase throughout government. I think it's excellent in the White House, but I think scientific literacy in government for the last several years is not where it should be, and I'm hoping that every one of our policymakers takes the time to learn to listen to the science and to take the science into account.
President Obama has said the swine flu should be a cause for concern rather than alarm. So far, there has been one death from swine flu in the United States. Sam Greenspan, FSRN, Washington.
Police used flash grenades to scatter thousands of May Day marchers in Athens, Greece today. Authorities say demonstrators attacked security cameras and banks, but no arrests were made. Although several arrests took place around the globe in what is commonly referred to as Labor Day in most of the world. A sinking economy has taken its toll on workers internationally, and hundreds of workers took to the streets today. Some 100 mostly youth protesters were taken into custody in Ankara, Turkey, after demonstrators clashed with police who used water cannons and tear gas to break up their protest. Authorities said protesters hurled rocks and gas bombs at police and attacked banks and high-end stores. About 200 people were arrested in Germany today. Most of those arrests happened after far-right skinheads clashed with a trade unionist march. France saw massive demonstrations today. Almost 300 marches and rallies were held across that nation as students and workers from varying sectors protested their government's policies during the recession. As the economic recession is fueling protests in many parts of the world, a different crisis is keeping workers off the streets. People in Mexico City traditionally take to the streets on May Day. Today, they can't. Their government has ordered all 103 million Mexicans to stay home, starting today until May 5th. Here in the United States, thousands are marching to demand respect and dignity for workers and immigrants. May Day demonstrations started at noon in New York City and are expected to last well into the evening. Many of the city's rallies focus on immigrant rights, a topic that brought more than 1 million people out to the nation's streets on the 1st of May, 2006. Today, we take you to a rainy Union Square park, where Community News Production Institute reporters spoke with immigrant workers and activists as the May Day demonstration began.
And we're here to support all immigrants because we think that rates need to stop now and we need a new immigration reform because we're separating immigrant families, and most of these families are hardworking families.
We are working very hard and very unsafe in any job, and I think that we deserve something else like immigration reform or legalization, because we don't have anything else.
So immigrants are being used right now to lower wages for those who work in the country. We can't have that.
So we think that Obama is going to make the change for us. So we're out here saying that we need it now. We can't wait no more because it's been years that the immigration reforms, it's been going on, but it never happens. But we have hope that now that Obama's in office, we can make it.
Immigrants are workers. whether they're so-called illegal or legalized immigrants. We are calling for every immigrant to be legalized in this country.
We're all immigrants. We all have the right to work and to just human rights equality. But we all have an immigrant background, and we just got to be accepting of whoever is here and whoever is anywhere in the world.
Well, the reason we should talk about immigrant rights is because immigrants are the are a strong part of the workforce in the United States, and it's also a way to outreach to the American workers to tell them that they are not going to change the working conditions if immigrant workers are also not included in terms of addressing their immigration status problems and issues.
So we say no more trampling on due process, no more ripping apart our families, no more criminalizing workers and pushing them into the underground.
You just heard from Carla Lopez, Felix Ortiz, Robert Blair, Sherry Finkelman, Scott Burbridge, David Jimenez, and Cheng Hua Hong, who spoke to FSRN from Union Square Park in New York City. This segment was produced by Abdelay Ba and Jacqueline Cook with the Community News Production Institute. Workers in Nigeria have started a series of nationwide protests and rallies to highlight mass factory closures and the unemployment that comes with it. Many factories, which once produced goods for export, are now warehouses for imports. And the Nigerian government pegs that nation's unemployment figure at about 30%. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
The protest song of the Nigerian workers says it all. They say they have decided to save the factories. To show how serious the issue of factory closures has become in Nigeria, the workers started their protest on the historic Apapa Oshodi Expressway in Lagos. In the past, there were about 25 textile factories along this road. Textile worker Oladele Ohunsu says all the companies have since shut down.
In fact, as I speak with you now, I'm in front of one of the biggest textile mills in Nigeria, Five Star Industries. It has been converted into a warehouse. We are imported rice as stocked. Opposite me here is Afprint. This is a factory that used to employ close to 5,000 workers when it was in existence. It has closed shops. What they are selling there now are automobiles. We can go on and on and on. We have close to 25 textile mills on this road alone. All have closed shop.
In recent years, Nigeria has suffered a collapse of infrastructures, especially electricity. This is the result of prolonged military rule and massive corruption. The consequence manifested about 10 years ago when companies started closing down. The situation has worsened even further with the current financial crisis. Julius Olariwaju, a member of Nigeria's Manufacturers Association, says Nigerian factories are closing down because the lack of infrastructures has pushed up the cost of production, making it difficult for them to compete with cheap imported goods.
There seems not to be protection in the local industry. And since we don't have the necessary infrastructure, that is affecting us, contributes to our cost of production. You cannot compete with goods produced in other parts of the world.
Dr. Sofiri Joab Peterside is with the Center for Advanced Social Science in the southeastern city of Port Harcourt. He says the mass unemployment and factory closures could lead to social and economic problems.
It's a very serious problem where you have people who already have a means of survival suddenly being thrown into the unemployment market. This can also escalate the crime situation because some of them are people who actually are not highly educated, but of course have a skill and have an engagement now thrown out. This is also another problem. Economic activities have gone down. So I think it is a very fundamental challenge, what we're seeing happening.
Should the factories come back?
Yes!
Should the factories come back?
Yes!
The workers will continue the protest nationwide until November 20. The end of the protest will coincide with the Africa Industrialization Day. It's a day set aside by the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO, to raise consciousness of the importance of industrialization to Africa. Newspaper reports quote Nigeria's Minister of Commerce and Industry, Achike Udenwa, as saying that the government is now investing heavily in basic infrastructures like energy and transportation in an effort to save the country's industries. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Thousands of people in Gaza have been out of work since Israel started restricting their entry into the Israeli labor market 9 years ago. And now, as FSRN's Rami Elmagari reports, hundreds of them face more challenges after insurance allowances were cut off in January of this year.
Masoud Raba is a 50-year-old Gaza worker. He is one of hundreds who were injured working inside Israel. He used to get disability insurance for this, but now he had his monthly insurance allowance withheld for the first time since 1979.
I support a family of seven, including my wife and I. Before, we couldn't afford to pay electricity bills. Now we can't afford groceries. As you can see, I sold my TV set and refrigerator in order to get by. What did we do to cause our allowances to be withheld? This allowance was handed down to us by the Israeli court. It's our given right.
More than 700 Palestinian workers who were exposed to work accidents inside Israel used to receive monthly insurance allowances from Israeli employers. But starting in January 2009, workers stopped receiving these payments. The Palestinian Workers Syndicate in Gaza does not have an answer to these workers' complaints, saying the matter is related to Israeli institutions or banks. Salama Abu Zaitar is a legal spokesperson for the syndicate.
Israeli courts are no longer considering Gaza Strip workers' issues. Recently, we in the syndicate's legal office found out that such courts regard the Gaza Strip as a hostile entity. This has led them to throw out workers' cases. Some of those workers have filed $1,000 or even $1 million lawsuits.
Last year, Israel stepped up measures against the Gaza Strip by declaring the region a hostile entity and preventing transactions between Israeli banks and Gaza-based banks. This shocked the finances of an already struggling population. About 85% of Gaza's 1.5 million people rely on food aid from the United Nations. Unemployment is also a major problem in Gaza. The Labor Ministry says it's now more than 65%. With the outbreak of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in late 2000, Israel began to impose restrictions on entry of Gaza laborers into Israel. In June 2007, Israel sealed off Gaza completely in the wake of Hamas's takeover of the territory. This caused some 100,000 people who worked in Israel to lose a primary source of work and income. Rami Elmagari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that will do it for today's newscast. I'm Catherine Kamp. Happy May Day.